Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
Wednesday, March 22nd, springtime. Is it feeling springtimey in West Virginia?
Yeah, man. It's going to be 64 degrees here today. You can't beat that. Except I just got back from Miami where it was, you know, in the 80s. But otherwise, it feels great to be in the 60s.
Not been to Miami. I've been to Orlando, Tampa, but not Miami, which I'm sure is like a whole different universe.
Yeah, it's a different world down there, man. But you got to get down there. I do recommend it.
So have you been to Florida pre-DeSantis as well as in the DeSantis regime?
I was in Palm Beach in January. I've probably been. But I will say I met up with I don't think they would mind me saying so. I met up with Mark Caputo while I was down there, and Kimberly Leonard, who are both
Caputo, the Florida reporter, Caputo, the Trump lackey,
the Florida Miami Herald, Politico, NBC News, and whatever comes next reporter, and Kimberly Leonard from Business Insider, who is on top. She's very good on top of the DeSantis political world. So I was able to get the lay of the land and hear about talk about the culture of politics down there and hear about their thoughts on DeSantis and Trump and factor that in.
Were you feeling how much freer Florida is now than when you have visited Florida in the past?
I mean, I go to Florida two or three times a year, and I could tell you that it was awesome to go there during COVID. I mean, especially there was a certain point when I was vaccinated, right? And I was not afraid of COVID. And I felt like schools were now closed needlessly and masking was essentially performative at this point. It was great to go to Florida and just let your guard down and like, you know, be a human again. So I really enjoyed that. But Bill, there is something. Florida culture, and I think it's a little bit like Louisiana in this regard. There's a sense that a hurricane could take them out at any moment. And so they live life on the edge. And I think that's an important thing to understand about the culture. So you'll see like helmets don't exist down there. People zooming around on scooters and motorcycles and these like weird hybrid is the wrong word, but they're sort of a car, but they're not really a car. Driving kind of dangerously. and this is not just a sort of I think some of this is in South Florida has, you know, the Cuban population, Venezuelan population. But I think this attitude is actually in the entire state of Florida. It's not limited to South Florida. So I think that informs the way they felt about COVID. They live on the edge. They take chances.
I wasn't going to start with DeSantis, but I did run my DeSantis piece this week. Do you want to start there since we're talking about it?
We're talking Florida, so we might as well, right?
First let's note DeSantis has made some news recently. I mean, so there already was. He kicked up a lot of dust around Ukraine with his response to Tucker Carlson. And I think there's still some residual fallout to that. In the past 2 days, he has made these kind of passive aggressive comments about Trump. One was about the presumably impending indictment over the Stormy Daniels case, where he was criticizing the prosecutor as being a George Soros prosecutor, the way other Republicans have. And then just happened to gratuitously throw in, I don't know what's up with this porn star thing. I mean, I'm not quite
able to. Yeah, I don't know what it's like to have to pay hush money. I can't speak to that alleged, you know, activity.
Right.
Yeah.
So he did that. And then he did an interview with Piers Morgan yesterday where, I mean, I feel like he's saying things that he has said in other venues, but strung them together. And then Piers Morgan wrote his own article for the New York Post about it, where he kind of add in his interpretation of your DeSantis really taking it to Trump with this and this and this, but they're all kind of these passive aggressive, indirect jabs. He's not really naming
Piers
Trump.
Morgan, by the way, does Piers Morgan work for Fox News? I'm confused. How's he involved in this?
I don't fully follow his career closely, okay. But I know he has a TV show. And he's one of those guys that always lands somewhere. So it might be that he has a Murdoch position on a British TV station and has access to the New York Post as well. I don't know.
Yeah. And I don't even know if he's on the left or the right or where that guy is.
I mean, he's a bit of a, I mean, I'd say he's more right than left, but he's definitely a heterodox.
So Amy Walter had a good piece where she talked about, you know, kind of saying what you and I said a couple of weeks ago, which is like, we're not going to know till August about if DeSantis can stand up to the pressure and the attacks from Trump. And then she, you know, she quoted Mike Tyson's famous line, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth or whatever that is. And I think that was a really good way of putting it. I will say when I watched the clip of DeSantis talking to Piers Morgan, obviously DeSantis has a plan, right? And he's going in there and you called it passive aggressive. And I think that's a good way of putting it, where he's able to subtly or in sort of attack Trump without fully mentioning Trump, and it's being very cute about the way that he does it. And Bill, I have to say, it doesn't seem to be working to me. There's something about his delivery, his facial expression, his tone that there's certain people that have this je ne sais quoi, right? Mm-hmm. We can't define what it is. Like Trump has something where he is a bully. He is the popular kid in school, and the rules don't apply to him. I'm feeling now when I see these clips of DeSantis, he's just a regular guy, and I don't think he's going to be able to pull this off. That's my sense today, that he's being smart. He's trying to be very precise in this plan of attack, but I see some trepidation. Maybe it's a sense of trepidation or fear. I just don't think he has it. We won't live until August.
That fear is party wide. I mean, the fact that Trump can say, how dare this prosecutor go after me? Everyone should pour out on the streets and protest. And instantaneously, every Republican, I can't think of one Republican who called Trump on his demagogic nonsense. I mean, people who are clearly never Trumpers, like Chris Sununu, for example, is talking about how, you know, politically driven prosecutions. They are all afraid to say Trump is a walking legal liability.
Yeah.
And so DeSantis is part and parcel of that, that he can't just pop Trump in the face.
Right. But it's also, I think that's true, but it's also like the reason that we had hope for DeSantis is that in his own milieu, right, in Florida, when he's behind the podium and he's controlling the room, he controls the means of production, right? You know, mm-hmm. He gets to call on the reporter, mm-hmm. and he's got the podium he's standing behind, and he is in his element. He's able to look very commanding in his element, yelling at a reporter if they get out of line. And we only see that clip, right? Right. And now he's in a different environment, right?
Christie was the same way.
Yeah. Now he's in someone else's studio and he's talking to Piers Morgan, not somebody from the Miami Herald, right? Or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, not some 22-year-old from the Miami Herald. He's talking to Piers Morgan and he's talking about Donald Trump, not about the Don't Say Gay bill or whatever. And the question was like, could he rise to the occasion and trans and be the same guy that is the tough guy in Florida? And I have to say, like, based on this one appearance, I don't think so.
Yeah. I mean, that's my gut reaction. Of course, these are just gut reactions. Maybe there'll be polling a week later that shows DeSantis having a boomlet. Yeah. So neither one of us should assume that our initial takes are definitive. But my going presumption is you beat Trump by beating Trump, by taking the fight to Trump, and saying that he is bad for these reasons and you should not nominate him. And if by doing it in kind of a cutesy coy way, I mean, you're seeing this, you know, DeSantis tried to dull the attack with a lot of attacks on the Manhattan DA. You know, this doesn't pacify Trump world. It doesn't make them reluctant to swing back. They excise all that from your statement and pound you on the other stuff. Because, you know, Trump's a brawler. So maybe if you had a much broader, deeper well of support. Like I think Obama was actually pretty good at shrugging things off because he had a swagger when he had a reservoir swagger. It wasn't always there, but he drew on when he needed to. And
I don't think it worked. Yeah, I think you're right. Obama could do that. I don't think DeSantis can do that.
Right. I mean, DeSantis is not the guy you want to have a beer with. DeSantis is not your buddy. DeSantis, you know, touches a certain nerve because he owns the libs in a way that is satisfying. But I think the argument that I'm so much more I mean, he doesn't use Trump by name. Like, I'm competent. I keep my eye on the ball. I get points on the board. I have a team that is loyal and there's no palace intrigue. I don't think that is compelling enough to say this makes me superior to Trump, because you're talking to an audience that was perfectly happy the way Trump went about doing things. So that's my guess. I mean, obviously some people weren't. I mean, there is a constituency that, I mean, DeSantis is not at zero. He's more like, you know, 20 or 30. So like there's somebody who likes it. But the starting place is that there's a bigger group that likes the way Trump did it. And a Porsche needs to be convinced that they're wrong. That's hard. I'm not saying it's an easy thing to do. If a guy's got a hard 40 in a multi-candidate race, maybe you're just going to lose and nothing you can do about it. But you got to change the contour of the race by making an active argument that people who are currently with Trump should have a reason to not be with Trump. And that means dragging him down a few pegs.
Someone in one of the many podcasts I listened to on an airplane yesterday, someone said that DeSantis is running like he's the front runner. This might have been Matthew Continetti. I don't know. Someone said, you know, DeSantis is running like he's the front runner or he's the incumbent, and Trump is running like he's the challenger. Mm-hmm. Now, look, I'm okay with DeSantis biding his time. He's not officially in the race yet. He's still the governor of Florida, and they're still in a legislative session, right? So it's not the strategy of what he's trying to do that I think is the problem. It's the execution. I don't think he's pulling it off. And I think what has been revealed is that he was able to very carefully cultivate this image in Florida, and it's not transferable now because running for president is like a different animal. And I think we're starting to see that he's a little bit awkward and he's not a great natural politician. He's not a political athlete. Like, he was great in this one context where he could control things. In a state that's very unique, as you know, and in a state where I think he's done a pretty good job. But that doesn't, you know, this is the NFL. That means not for long if DeSantis doesn't improve. Can he improve? I'm skeptical of that, too. It's possible.
I mean, look, Barack Obama, at the beginning of the 2008 primary, early 2007, was not great. You go back and look at, there was a somewhat well-known appearance. It was an SEIU healthcare forum, and he was underprepared and did not seem like he was as fluent on policy as Hillary was. And it wasn't a great, you know, initial beginning to his campaign, and he knew it, he recognized it, and he made adjustments.
I think Obama always had flashes of brilliance. Going back to that 2004 convention speech, you saw that there was potential. I think, you know, DeSantis is Kirk Cousins, maybe. Like, he's serviceable, but probably never going to be a great politician, a great orator.
I don't want to assume limitations. You know, I mean, again, I'm speaking just strictly in terms of political candidate skill. Any one of these people has the capacity to improve. So just because they did a certain thing at the front stage of a campaign doesn't mean they won't make adjustments and do better later. And look, DeSantis obviously has some skills. He is where he is. He is in at least second place in this race, where a lot of other people who had plenty of opportunities, plenty of swings of the bat, you know, aren't. I might pull away just for a second to make sure that my dog's not choking on something.
But he's going up against
for a bit.
He's going up against a political animal.
You riff. I'll be right back.
Okay. Hey guys, welcome. Make sure to subscribe. If you're listening to the podcast, you can go to youtube.com/Matt Lewis and subscribe to our YouTube page. We appreciate that. You should also follow us on Twitter at DMZ Show. And you could support us at patreon.com/Matt Lewis or patreon.com/Bill Share. That helps us out, helps us keep doing what we do.
Did you riff with plugs, Matt?
I did, because I knew it was vital that you hear my analysis.
That's a pro. That's a pro. You should give Matt $5 on the Patreon just for that.
Thank you, Bill. And this will say, we don't have to repeat it necessarily at the end. We've gotten the dirty, shameless, I don't know, business out of the way. And now we can get back to what I was saying is, you know, look, can DeSantis grow? I think that people can learn on the job and grow. But the problem is, try doing that with Donald Trump. Well, you know, look, you're trying to climb this ladder, right?
And he's throwing pianos at you. I do not envy anyone with the task of defeating Donald Trump in a Republican primary. He is a hard person. Bullies are hard. It's hard to deal with a bully when you're in fifth grade. You know, bullies are difficult characters to grapple with. Now, I think DeSantis has grown, quote unquote, from where he was as a backbencher House member when no one thought he was going to be where he is today. He has made adjustments over the course of his career. He's adapted to be more compelling to the current state of the Republican Party. So he has that ability to adapt, but it's one thing to recognize, oh, I just got to be crazier and crazier and meaner and meaner to get in good with the base. Like, that's sort of a relatively easy strategy to take on. Now you got to navigate Donald Trump. You have to find a way to be your own tough guy while saying this other tough guy is flawed in some way. That's complicated.
Well, and speaking of adapting, Bill, did you see that Ron DeSantis has adapted how he pronounces his own last name?
I saw that sort of a supercut of the way his pronunciation has changed. That sort of thing doesn't really, you know, get under my skin.
I think it does matter. So for those who haven't seen it or haven't heard it, there are clips of Ron DeSantis as recently as like a year or two ago when he's the governor of Florida, introducing himself. Hi, I'm Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. I'm Ron DeSantis. And then later he says, I'm Ron DeSantis. And I think there's something about that bothers people. It's sort of like, remember when Hillary Clinton had that Arkansas accent screamed, I'm a phony? I feel like the same thing. Now, the irony is, I was talking to my wife, whose name's Aaron, I think it's pronounced DeLulo. Mm-hmm. And she's like, no, I think it's DeLula. So
that's why it doesn't bother me, because I've seen other families have slight different ways they pronounce their names. I think even the Hillary thing. I mean, I've been in the South for a couple of weeks, and you find yourself kind of slipping into a Southern accent when you're surrounded by it. So I could see she slipped into it when she was Arkansas First Lady, and then
I'm not
she fell out of it when she got to D.C.
I'm not saying it's not understandable. I'm saying I think it hurts. I think juxtaposing the video of a guy at the age of 44 who, for political purposes ostensibly, has decided to start pronouncing his name differently, I think that does speak to some sort of – people will interpret it as a character issue.
They might. They might. What is in his mouth now?
What are you – are you worried that your dog is dying?
I just dealt with like two pet – medical crises.
Oh, that's
which were,
true. Yeah,
which were cats, right? not cheap. So I'm definitely constantly on watch of like them ingesting something they shouldn't
trust
be ingesting.
Me. No, I remember one time, Bill, someone gave me a Christmas present, and I brought it home and I put it under the tree. And what I didn't know is that it was a bag of dark chocolate, like Dove dark chocolate.
Yeah, yeah.
And these were like individually wrapped. And it was wrapped in a Christmas, wrapping paper. And my pug, Uncle Rico, while I was gone, ate an entire bag, including the wrapping paper, the plastic, and the little tin wrappings around each dark chocolate. And it was not cheap.
Yeah.
It was not cheap. And it was not fun for anybody, I can assure you.
Yeah. Wait, back to a more fun topic, Ron DeSantis.
Yes.
Everyone's pal. I wrote about Ron DeSantis for the Washington Monthly this week.
Oh, yeah. Look, you got some good buzz for that, Bill.
Thank you.
This is the one with the picture of Dukakis wearing a helmet juxtaposed with DeSantis wearing a helmet.
Right, which I make a Dukakis parallel at the end of the piece. I actually thought about it as a headline. I was like, it's not really about Dukakis. It's about DeSantis overselling his record in Florida. So like my suggested headline wasn't the Dukakis, but the monthly editors, thought differently. And I think, hey, I think it worked out. But the main point really is, if you've seen the initial DeSantis stump, he has a part where he says, Florida is where woke goes to die. We are the beacon of freedom. And people are voting with their feet. We are the fastest growing state. And he even throws in there, we've had like this huge influx of wealth into the state. And while California and New York and these woke states are on the decline. I didn't go like that deep under the hood. I went a little bit under the hood. And just looking at the population growth numbers. So, for a while, last several years, Idaho has been the fastest growing. And one of those years was Nevada. These are smaller population states. So it takes a small number of people coming into their states for their percentage growth to be highest. And probably some of that is California overflow, because California has got the highest housing cost in the nation. So Florida has been a strong performer in population growth for decades because there's a steady flow of older people who want to retire to Florida. That's a perennial. And their housing costs are very reasonable, relatively speaking.
And there's no state income tax.
Right. So in the last year, Florida's population growth was 1.9%. That made him number one. You look at the last term of Rick Scott before DeSantis gets in, every year was between 1.5 and 1.8. The first few years of DeSantis, they were 1.0, 1.1. It's just in 2022, it pops up to 1.9. And this, at the same time, Idaho, which had been at 2.0 and a little bit higher, in 2022, they were down to 1.8. It was a little bit of a tick down. So you look at that, and it's not like, wow, Florida's gangbusters all of a sudden. They're pretty much doing what they've always been doing. And Idaho, slipped a little bit. And now at the same time, I looked at the age demographics. Because DeSantis argues this is not just the typical retiree. because there's always people from California are coming to Florida all of a sudden. So it's clearly because they hate the wokeness. That's why they're coming to Florida. It's not just old people who like warm weather. But the share of people in Florida who are senior citizens has grown slightly since DeSantis came in, and even more so going back to like 2010. The population growth of people under 65 in Florida is down. Not by a huge amount, but it's still a drop. That's not what's contributing to the overall growth. It's still retirees. And I didn't get into this in the article because it was a little too much, but that's also where the wealth comes from. You know, old people come with retirees coming. Yes, they are wealthier than 22-year-olds looking for their first job. So there's nothing really here that really signals. And one more thing I'd add, the LA Times did its own analysis of California migration, and the numbers just aren't that big. It's like about 30,000 people who came from California to Florida, which was largely offset by people from Florida moving to California. And those California people also age-wise were skewing old. So this just really seems like the usual Florida growth, as opposed to something that DeSantis has done extra special to attract people. And just to close it out, I'm not arguing that DeSantis would lose the presidential election because he's been caught in this lie and the fact checkers are going to bring him down. Like, everyone puffs up their record. You know, like, that's, you know, I'm sure if Glenn Kessler at the Washington Post did this, he'd get like, you know, two Pinocchios and not four Pinocchios, and it would be forgotten. Like, it's like, I'm not saying this is like the greatest prevarication of all time, but if you're a Republican voter and you're trying to decide who's the most electable person, if that is your criteria, maybe for a lot of Republicans it isn't, but let's say that is the criteria you're going on, you should not follow the logic that, oh, DeSantis went from 0.4% in 2018 to 19.4% in 2022. He must have some political magic. He must know how to flip blue states to red. And he doesn't have to do it in some sort of mealy mouth Larry Hogan, Charlie Baker way. He can be super duper conservative and stick it to those woke bastards on the coast. And that's how he's going to get us Florida. That's going to get Arizona and Georgia and Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania back. Like, that's not what this data is saying. Because as you were saying earlier, Florida is its own thing. Florida is its own weird culture. And politically, over the past decade, it has gone right while other states have gone left. So Florida just bring in more old people who, guess what, skew conservative already. That is not evidence he's going to bring back these other states that flipped the Democrats' way in 2020. So if I'm a discerning Republican voter, like, that should alarm me.
I think that's all good. And just for, you know, to connect the dots, the Dukakis comparison would be the Massachusetts miracle. That's
right.
Democrats said this guy's a great governor, therefore he should be the president. And you had a line, correct me if I'm wrong, that I think was great. It was something to the effect of Florida is not where woke goes to die. It's where people go to die.
Right.
Just to sum it up, I think that was
quite nice. The Dukakis point, obviously Dukakis, I think, is a more decent human being than Ron DeSantis. But the point is, he tried to sell his state as a model that he could spread throughout the country. What did George H.W. Bush do? Take Massachusetts values and shove them down his throat. This guy released prisoners of first degree murderers on furlough, and they won't veto the Pledge of Allegiance. And I forget a couple others, but like,
it's attacking the person's strongest argument, not their weakest.
Exactly. Yeah. You can't assume that the rest of the country is hankering for Florida values. There's no evidence of that in what we've seen in the past election cycles.
It would be fun to do the whole Florida man thing, but since Trump also lives in Florida and probably wants to win Florida, you know, it's not the same as attacking Massachusetts, the People's Republic, or whatever. Well,
I'm curious if Trump goes there and is like, he's nothing special. I've been in Florida for a while. Like, he's not doing anything that's so great. Florida was like this when he got here. He's not doing anything that I wouldn't do or couldn't do as president. And I know because I live there.
Yeah. It wouldn't surprise me. And you know, Trump, you probably saw this, Bill, but Trump took umbrage to Ron DeSantis's comments about paying off porn stars hush money. And I guess retruthed that photo of DeSantis and presumably these high school girls, students or whatever that he had taught. And Trump said something to the effect of, you know, nice political career you have there. It'd be a shame if something happened to it.
That's where, I mean, that's where the little jabs from DeSantis, at least you can't assume they're going to blunt the roundhouses coming from Trump.
Yeah. And Trump basically said, like, DeSantis is probably going to learn what it feels like to have false allegations about impropriety leveled at you, something like that.
Now, do you think that Republicans are correct in thinking that if Trump is indicted in the Stormy Daniels case, that is going to be good for Trump in the larger scheme of things, and therefore they should be standing with Trump throughout it all?
Well, I mean, I think it's complicated, right? So I do think that there are, like, what, three or four different potential legal challenge, you know, problems that Trump is facing. And this one, you know, some people argue that it resonates because sex sells, and just like a sex scandal with, you know, say Bill Clinton's Monica Lewinsky scandal got a lot of attention. It's like a TMZ story. It's not just a, you know, New York Times story. Other people, I think, say, like, we're at a point now in our culture where people are be more kind of dismissive of a sex scandal, and it looks like kind of weak, you know, whatever, weak sauce. I don't know what the expression is, but like, I think there is an argument to be made that, like, this is, maybe this is politicized. I'm not trying to be like Ron DeSantis, both sides here, but I think there is an argument that, like, come on, of all the horrible things Trump has done, this is what you guys are leading with. Having said that, I think that the thing we kind of learned from Mar-a-Lago is that initially there's a rally around Trump effect, and then that lasts for like a month. And then once the rally around Trump effect moves on, it's like, okay, this guy's just too much drama. So I think my guess is, in the short term, it helps Trump. In the long term, it will hurt him, certainly to some degree. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I take your point that, like, if you were trying to orchestrate this, you probably wouldn't lead with Stormy Daniels. It's not the most serious charge that is looming out there. Of course, the fact that it is the thing that might go first is evidence that Democrats are not orchestrating this. This is not some sort of scripted political attack. So they'd much rather, you know, indict over a January 6th related thing, or the Georgia thing where he's caught trying to, you know, steal votes in Georgia. That's why if I'm a Republican, I would say to myself, I know this isn't the first and last thing out there. I know there's probably more coming that's going to be harder and harder to defend. And sure, it might be what's the safe ground to stand on during this primary season, but it's really toxic to the party over the long haul. As we just saw in the 2022 general election, election denialism is total political death. There's such opportunity for Republicans to rip off the Band-Aid here.
But I still think there's a belief, and it may be misguided. It may not be based on reality or evidence, but Trump still has this feeling that he's magical. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think in a normal world, Republicans would look at this, if any other Republican in history were indicted, you know, at this point in a presidential race, they would be done. And partly because the Republican voter would assume that that they're going to lose, that they can't win. You can't win. And that the press is going to destroy them. And so it wouldn't be that the Republican voter necessarily is moving on, but they're moving on because just the perception that no one could overcome this. But Trump has this almost magical, people have a magical belief in Trump. And so I don't think that those rules apply to him. There's a sense that he is Houdini, that he always, that he always comes out of it, lands on his feet somehow.
Did you see the Al Franken and Lindsey Graham interview on The Daily Show?
Just the main clip about who would have thought that a porn star would be the one who takes him down? You know, well, all of us.
Well, I haven't watched the entire thing, but I watched the part at the front end where they talked about Ukraine. And, you know, Trump, Franken initially is, you know, agreeing with Graham about Ukraine. Here's something we agree on. We both think we have to stand with Ukraine and defeat Putin. And Graham is all over that. He's like, you know, Putin sucks. Yeah, it wouldn't be great to see Putin lose. You know, we got to be in this to win. And he's being marginally nice to Biden. There's a little bit of like, I think he should send out F-16s, but he's like, I'm trying to be supportive and have a united front here. And then Franken's like, you know what your guys say about Ukraine? And he's, you know, he cites some quotes. And this is the first time I've really seen, I think Graham was asked by some reporters about Trump in a gaggle recently, and I just saw some stuff on Twitter about it, and I didn't see the video. This is the first I've sort of seen him be on video, a little bit of an extended exchange. And you know, Graham has already kind of laid into DeSantis on this. He has much more point about DeSantis. So when Franken asked, you know, Graham's like, yeah, that was a mistake. What Trump said, you know, that was a mistake. I'm not saying I agree with that. I thought Trump did a great job going after the terrorists. Like he just enough for Graham not to contradict himself, but as fast as possible, he moved on to a different topic.
Mm-hmm.
And there was basically a look in Graham's eyes where he's basically said, like, I know this is bullshit. You know, I know this is totally incoherent, but I'm not going to say it. You're not going to get me to say it. I'm not going to really criticize them, you know, vociferously the way I do with DeSantis. I'm just going to say, yeah, you know, I don't agree, but I sure love all these other things. The thing about Trump is, this is to go back to what you were saying before.
Yeah.
Yeah, they think that maybe he can still win. So they're not willing, and they know they need his voters to win. So they're not willing to really take it to him. But they know election denialism is toxic, and they know Trump's foreign policy is abominable. And they don't really believe it themselves. So like, if I were them, I'd be like, I don't care if we lose this election. He does not represent what this party should stand for, and we have to defeat this within the party. But that's not the path they're choosing to take. They're choosing the grand path, which is, you know, just close your eyes as much as possible and just try to get past it.
Before we move on from this and from Stormy, I just wanted to see if you could, I don't know if you know this or not. I've been kind of out of the loop a little bit, but I've heard that like paying off Stormy Daniels was actually not illegal. Like paying hush money and whatever state he did it in was not illegal. What is the actual like crime? Are you clear on that?
I'm not the expert here, so I definitely go to others who have researched this more. But my understanding is the question were things reported accurately?
Mm.
If you're spending money related,
is it a campaign contribution in
right,
a sense? Right,
right.
Because if you're doing it to clear the way for you to run for president, then that's a campaign expense, right?
Right, which should be reported.
Yes, okay.
I believe that is the crux of the matter.
Okay, that makes sense. Bill, before we wrap up, you had, you know, there was this news that came out from Peter Baker, I think, at the New York Times, and you had a really good tweet about it. But why don't you set it up and tell us your take?
Well, the big news from Peter Baker at the Times was an interview he did with Ben Barnes, who was a Texas Democrat, but one who's had good relations with Republicans. Him saying that he was on a trip with John Connolly, who was a Democrat turned Republican, who visited Arab countries in 1980 with the message that you should tell Iran to not release the hostages during the 1980 campaign because you'll get a better deal with Reagan. And that Barnes said that kind of took that trip and reported back to William Casey, who was a Reagan operative, later became head of the CIA. Now, it was in the Baker story that Barnes had actually said this previously, so it wasn't all that new. I think he gave some more details to Baker. I think the reporting back to Casey, I think, was new in that account. But I have the H.W. Brands Reagan bio. Brands talked to Ben Barnes as well on his part about this notion that there was contact between the Reagan campaign and the Iranians is not new. And this is called the October surprise theory. This is what Brands wrote. In 2013, Ben Barnes, former Lieutenant Governor of Texas, told the present author he had accompanied former Texas Governor John Connally on a trip to the Middle East in the summer of 1980. Connally made a run for the Republican nomination that year, but after a slow start, he dropped out, endorsing Reagan over George Bush. Barnes had handled fundraising for the Connally campaign. Connally, who had served as a Treasury Secretary for Nixon and was clearly hoping for an important post in a Reagan administration, was an associate with a Houston-based law firm, and the purpose was described in the firm's records as personal business for private interest. But public business was in prospect. Recommendations by Nixon preceded Connally to the Middle East. Quote, I'm sure you will find a talk with him most interesting in view of his enormous experience in government and the likelihood I hope that he will play a major role in the Reagan administration, Nixon wrote to one foreign interlocutor. And it goes on to say, Barnes volunteered to the author that the trip had a connection to the American hostages in Iran. Barnes said that Connally passed word to the government officials he met with in Israel and several Arab countries that the release of the hostages before the November election would, quote, not be helpful, unquote, to the Reagan campaign. When asked by the author whether this message had come from William Casey, Barnes said he wasn't told and had not inquired. So that's what, and also it says here, early in the journey, Connally seems to have spoken by phone with Reagan. A memo to Connally by an aide bore the subject line, Governor Reagan, and read, Nancy Reagan called there at the ranch. He wants to talk to you about being in on strategy meetings. Although he doesn't say we don't know what was actually the content of their conversations. Now there's also another line here, which is, what did Casey do? Because there's some evidence that Casey was in Madrid, possibly with a similar objective. And also in the Brands book here, there was a government commission looked into this and couldn't conclude that Casey was in Madrid. That says here in the book, but the administration declined to share evidence indicating that William Casey had been in Madrid at the time of the alleged meeting between Casey and the Iranian contacts. A memorandum for the record by White House Associate Counsel Paul Beach recounted a conversation between Beach and Edwin Williamson of the State Department. Williamson explained that the State Department was gathering relevant materials and deciding what to turn over to investigators. Beach wrote, quote, in this regard, Ed mentioned only a cable from the Madrid embassy indicating that Bill Casey was in town for purposes unknown, unquote. The Beach memorandum, when released, surprised Lee Hamilton, who was on this commission. Hamilton condemned the Bush White House for withholding the evidence. Quote, if the White House knew that Casey was there, they certainly should have shared it with us, unquote. So So there's two lines here. There's this Casey line. There's the Connolly line. Barnes is giving more evidence that the Connolly trip was about sending this message. So I think that there's very good evidence here that people in Reagan's orbit were sending this message. Now, there's this other question, which is not mentioned in the Baker article. Does that mean the Iranians, you know, heeded that advice, that they changed their plans because of what Casey or Connolly said? And there's another great book that I really recommend, Guess the Ayatollah by Mark Bowden, which is about the whole hostage crisis. And on the whole, I'd say pretty favorable to Carter and how he handled it. So it's not like he's in the tank for Reagan here, but he talked to the Iranians involved. So there's one in particular named Mohammad Mousavi Koniha, who was believed to have engineered the whole operation, later became kind of on the outs with the Iranian government. But it says, he dismissed as immaterial the popular American theory of an October surprise, the theory mounted most compellingly by former Carter advisor Gary Sick. And this is several years ago before this New York Times article. Sick shows that several of Reagan's advisors, most notably his campaign manager, William Casey, intervened through Iranian friends in the summer and fall of 1980 in an effort to prolong the hostages' ordeal to after the November elections. Sick makes a strong case that such contacts were made, and the efforts were confirmed by Koniha, several of other hostage takers, and also Sadeh Tabatabi, the former provisional government official who instigated the talks with Warren Christopher of the Carter administration that eventually led to Hasha's release. Like the cleric, they found the Reagan campaign's efforts a revealing peek at the cynical underside of American politics, but they said they had little bearing on Iran's decision to hang on to the hostages until Carter officially left office. At least all the hostage takers I interviewed said the decision to wait until Carter officially left office was deliberate, a final insult to the man they had propped up as the representative of the devil on earth. They already had reason to screw Carter. They didn't need the Reagan people to tell them what a good idea that was. So I think the evidence is the Reagan people tried to do it, which is illegal to do. It's illegal to conduct diplomacy if you're not part of the government. But to say that changed the course of history.
Someone better tell Mike Flynn that, Bill.
But I don't think it changed the course of history. I think the Iranians were going to do that anyway. So that's my take of it all.
I think that, I mean, that sounds right. I mean, for me, we'll probably never know, but I sincerely hope that Reagan was not involved in this. If in fact,
and there's no evidence of that. I mean, yeah. There's this little thing that Connolly may have talked to Reagan about something. Otherwise, we have no indication that Reagan told Casey to do this.
Because I probably don't have to say this, but not only is it illegal to conduct foreign policy, and I think, as I recall, Ted Kennedy might have even done some things to undermine Reagan during the Cold War. But not only
he's a government official, so that's a little different. Fair.
Yeah. Still bad, but you're right. Is it the Wagner Act? What's that called? I can't remember.
It's the Logan Act.
The Logan Act. And do you know where that's mentioned, by the way? The Logan Act is mentioned if you watch the movie Charlie Wilson's War with Tom Hanks. There's a scene where Tom Hanks says, like, they're going to get me for violating the Logan Act, which I had never heard of when the movie first came out. But then it became very, you know, in around 2016, at 2017, it became a big thing. I don't have to say this probably, but not only would it be illegal, but it is just would be despicable. I mean, it would be despicable from a political standpoint to try to destroy Jimmy Carter based on this. But just imagine if you are a hostage and you have to stay there an additional month or two or whatever, or if you're the family of someone who has been taken hostage, and that's an extra, I mean, month, or I don't even know how long it would have been, but like, well, your audio's out, Bill.
I'm trying to keep the dog from barking.
Okay, you're back now.
Right. No, but we're talking, you know, this is allegedly in the summer and fall, and they didn't get released till January. So you're talking theoretically half a year. But again, to go back to the Mark Bowden book here, he writes, Iran was desperate enough in its need for military parts by the fall to consider releasing the hostages early. Thus, Tabatabi's efforts in September, blessed by the Iman himself, which he believes would have borne fruit before the U.S. election day, were it not for the outbreak of war with Iraq. Even with the distraction of the war, Iran's leadership made one last effort to tempt Carter just days before the vote, floating a complex new offer and urging the president to respond immediately via a press conference. It seems apparent to me that neither of these efforts would have been made if Iran had already struck a deal with the Reagan campaign. Likewise, if such a deal had been made, if Iran already gotten what it wanted from the president-elect, why keep the hostages after Carter's defeat for almost 3 months more? The nation was in desperate need of its military parts, and the students themselves were weary of serving as jailers. In this case, the most likely explanation seems the obvious one. The deal to release the hostages was complicated, and it took 3 months of difficult negotiations to achieve.
Yeah. So before we go, what did you think of the actual Peter Baker piece that kind of revealed this? Like, do you think it... Now, the problem is, I think some people just see the headline and they think, oh, Reagan obviously orchestrated this horrible thing. But do you feel like the actual report was accurate and nuanced enough that it... Like, the framing of it, what'd you think of it?
Well, first, I love Peter Baker. So I just think he's just an exceptional reporter and historian. He's done just amazing work. I might have brought in some of this stuff from Bowden's work in particular to say, you know, I think he had a line in there. I have to go back and look. I think he had a line about how we don't know if it's Reagan himself. You know, we don't necessarily know how the Iranians responded to this. So I think he had the caveats in there, but obviously the emphasis is, you know, this big new news. And of course, people ran with that, this notion of how this might have, you know, changed the course of history. So, you know, I might spend a little bit more time, the headline here is one man's story of sabotaging Carter's reelection. You know, the headline, because the headline's not Peter Baker's fault.
Right.
You know, that gives the impression that it did sabotage the election. And it might have been the intent might have been to sabotage the election. You know, just like, you know, Russia may have had the intent to throw the election to Donald Trump, which was interesting, doesn't mean that their actions are what actually did it. But the intent was there. So, you know, I might have done a little more in the story to try to, you know, dampen that perception. But I think the information, the story is still important information. To get Barnes on the record like that is an important piece of the puzzle. And I did see that, you know, there was pushback from David Frum that, you know, well, Connally, you know, wasn't really a Reagan guy. And there's no reason to think that he was really tight with the camp. So, you know, he seemed to be more skeptical about it. But I think the Frum thread didn't really get into what we also knew separately about Casey's activities. And just because they weren't pals in the first place doesn't mean that Connally wasn't trying to like ingratiate himself with them and try to impress Casey with what he was doing. So,
but he could have been freelancing that without any, you know, that's the other thing.
Yeah, I think it's very possible that Connally went off on his own and tried to impress Casey with it, but that doesn't exonerate Casey because probably Casey was doing his own stuff.
Maybe. All right. Jimmy Carter has gotten a lot of attention in 2023. I would not have predicted that Jimmy Carter this is probably our second conversation, a TMZ conversation about Jimmy Carter in the month. So hopefully we won't have another.
He's hard to take down.
Yes, he is. All right. Since I've already shamelessly self-promoted and plugged the DMZ and our Patreon and the YouTube channel and the Twitter feed, Bill, any final thoughts or plugs?
Oh, yeah, I've already plugged my DeSantis piece of the monthly, so go check that out. And I guess we'll talk again next week.
You got it. We'll see you back here in the DMZ. Have a good one, Bill.
Take care.